Okay, thank you, and thanks to the organizers and all the participants. It's good to be here. I'm very well aware that this is an extremely mixed audience, so I'm going to try and walk a tightrope between my background, which is quantum field theory, and some atomic physics and laser physics. So I undoubtedly will not completely succeed, but we're here for a program, so if you have any questions, we discuss plenty of time to discuss later. Okay, so this is a recent paper with my grad student, Rob Dabrowski. And from the quantum field theory point of view, it's a little bit strange. So let me go through. The whole idea of watching or asking when particle production actually happens, it's not the usual question we ask in quantum field theory. So let me just give a brief introduction, because there have already been several talks about the Schwinger effect, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. The basic idea is that if you apply an external electric field to the QED vacuum, the virtual dipole pairs in the vacuum feel the external field, the virtual electrons and positrons can be accelerated in opposite directions, and if the field is strong enough, then maybe they can go on shell and become real particles asymptotically. That's the basic physical argument. This goes back a long way to work by Heisenberg and Euler in the mid-1930s. A very rough estimate of when you might expect this to happen is comparing the work done in separating these guys by a Compton wavelength with the energy needed to produce two particles. Now, this gives an estimate of some literally astronomical electric field strength. If you rewrite it in terms of intensity language, it's around 10 to the 29 watts per square centimeter. Okay, so this calculation was done many times throughout history, and this is called the Schwinger critical field. However, the estimate of this goes back to work by Euler, who was Heisenberg's student, and it was based on a solution of the Dirac equation done by Sauter, even before the Dirac interpretation of the Dirac C existed. So, even though these are huge, there's been big progress in high-intensity lasers, but this is still experimentally inaccessible. However, this estimate is based on a constant field approximation, and I'm going to argue that this is a bad approximation, and we can improve upon it. So realistic short pulse lasers have interesting spatial and, more importantly, temporal substructure. There can be an envelope, there can be carrier phase, there can be chirp, there can be focusing. All these effects are completely neglected in that estimate that I just showed you. And so the big question from the quantum field theory point of view is, what is the effect of these inhomogeneities on these estimates of particle production rates? And it turns out from the cases we've studied that the particle production is extremely sensitive to these, and the physical reason is quantum interference, and that's what I'll explain. And if we can understand this in enough detail, we can learn to take advantage of this to enhance the effect, to hopefully bring it within the experimentally accessible regime. And what we know so far is that we don't understand the full optimization problem, but what we do understand is that relatively simple, well, to theorists, simple modifications of pulse structure can actually lower the critical intensity by several orders of magnitude. So that's good news. So in pictures, here's the estimate of a constant electric field. The next step was taken based on the work of Keldysh in the ionization problem, who took the monochromatic time-dependent electric field as a model of a laser. This was then adapted to the quantum field theory QED work by Popov in the Soviet Union. And in France, this was Edouard Brezin's PhD thesis, working with his advisor, Claude Itzigsen. They calculated the pair production rate in a monochromatic time-dependent electric field. There's also a very interesting result due to Nikishov, where if you take a time-dependent single pulse of a very special form, one of a Koch squared, it's analytically soluble. You can simply do the calculation from beginning to end, and this is extremely useful in comparing to approximations that you make in non-soluble cases. So these were both done around 1970. And things sort of died for a little bit, partly because the problem is very difficult. And even after the first flourish of interest in lasers, it was still clear that this was inaccessible with lasers at that time. So now this is, people are looking at this again, and some of the results we have is if you consider cases where there's an envelope and subcycle structure, either with zero carrier phase or pi over two carrier phase, or if you include chirp in the field, then it has dramatic effects on the particle production rate.
And dramatic meant four orders of magnitude, or?
Yes, and have exponential enhancement. Yeah, this is a really a non-perturbative problem. So I'm going to talk almost entirely in this talk about the Schwinger effect. This is this QED version. But let me just give you some more motivation from my perspective, is that there are also gravitational analogs of these. Now, at a superficial level, you can just say that, you know, gravitational fields produce acceleration, just like electric fields produce acceleration. And by the equivalence principle, there should be some comparison. It's not that simple. The causal structure in gravity is extremely different from the causal structure in QED, and it's not at all clear whether you can make analogs, electromagnetic analogs of these gravitational effects. But nevertheless, this is an extremely interesting problem to pursue. So there are these famous examples. And at the end, if I have time, I'll mention this cosmological particle production problem. So let me give two slides on the QED picture. And as I said, if you don't know this, you're not going to learn it in 10 minutes. But let me give you the words and the approach. And if you want to learn about it more during the next few weeks, I'm very happy to talk about it in detail. So there's something called the QED effect of action. This was developed by these guys. It's the amplitude from going from the in vacuum to the out vacuum. You write it as the exponential of something. The quantity and exponent is defined, that's the definition of the effect of action. A here means the vector the four vector potential, the gauge field, corresponding to the laser pulse that happens between in and out that you apply to the system. Then the vacuum persistence probability is the modulus squared of this. If nothing interesting is happening, this is 1. If something interesting is happening, namely pair production, this is not 1, and it's the deviation from 1 is encoded in the fact that this can have an imaginary part. Okay, if this is real, then clearly this is just 1. This is typically very small, so it's reasonable to make an expansion, but not always. But it's conventional when this is small to make this expansion. And then this deviation from 1 is interpreted as the probability of producing particles from vacuum, the deviation from 1. Okay? But it's very important to realize that this gives you the total deviation from 1. Now, there's a formal mathematical definition due to these people, is if you want to actually do a calculation, gamma is the log det of the Dirac operator. So d slash is the covariant derivative. This is what couples the electrons to the laser. And slash is because it's a Dirac problem, so there's some spinners floating around. And this is the mass of the electron. And you need to put in an I epsilon prescription to take care of the fact that there are electrons and positrons and get all the causal structure correct. So this was formalized by these people back in the 1950s. You have to also deal with renormalization. This is something that goes well beyond the usual single particle problems of the Dirac equation. But we understand formally how to do that. And this is a very simple computation for a constant electric field, because you know everything about the spectrum for the Dirac operator for a constant electric field. Okay? However, for realistic laser pulses, first of all, it's a much more difficult calculation. Secondly, we actually want more information than just the deviation from 1. What we would actually like is some information about the momentum distribution of the particles that are produced. If you have an electric field that's, say, linearly polarized, then the particle production will be predominantly along the direction of the field, but not only, but predominantly. But it will depend on the momentum, that longitudinal momentum. And for interesting fields, it depends on that momentum in extremely non-trivial ways. And that information is not sitting there. That information, you have to work much harder to extract that information, but that's experimentally important information. So spectra, momentum distributions, this is what we want. And what we really want is the optimization problem and the quantum control problem. Is that I should be able to approach a laser physicist and say, you should construct a laser pulse, namely a vector potential here, that looks like this to give the biggest effect so that we can actually finally see this. Okay? I should be able to do that. And we don't know how to do that yet. Okay? This is an extremely difficult problem. And then there are also conceptual problems as well as computational problems. What happens about back reaction? This is an approximation that takes the laser field to be completely classical, a background field. You do the calculation for quantized electrons and positrons in this background field, and you completely neglect the fact that the produced electrons and positrons are going to affect the electromagnetic field. Okay? So there's this problem clearly should be done, including quantized electromagnetic fields. But this is very hard. Usually it's probably not that important because the effect is so small. But from a fundamental point of view, this is an extremely important question.
Yes. So do we know any conditions for the A, this full vector, that any condition we know for sure you will have like this, so the imaginary part will not be zero, or any conditions for
that? All right, so there has to be an electric component to the field. If it's purely magnetic, nothing happens, okay? There's no particle. So it has to be an electric component. That's the simplest step. And then you can ask about localization of the field in both space and in time. So the real question, you know, the money question, is that intensity costs money. Right? So I should be able to say, you know, you give me a budget of how much intensity, and I should be able to tell you how to redistribute that in the pulse so that you get the most signal. Okay? And that's the quantum control and optimization problem. And that hasn't even been precisely formulated in a way that it can actually be solved. But I'm hopeful. So here's the basic picture. You start off with vacuum at t equals minus infinity. You apply some pulse to this vacuum, and it turns on, it turns off, and there's a new vacuum at the end. Okay? And in this new vacuum, there can be both electrons and positrons present. The question is, how many? What's the distribution? How can I shape this guy to make this more and more positrons there? Now, what we know so far, and I'll give you examples as we go along, is that if you really consider the substructure of this pulse, you can shape this pulse to dramatically increase this. Now, what that means is that something interesting is happening inside this envelope of the pulse. But the way it's formulated in standard quantum field theory language is in S matrix language, where you ask about what happens here, and you compare it to the final thing here, and you don't even ask the question of what's happening in the intermediate region here. So I want to turn the question around and ask, how much can we say about what's going on in here, and how physically unique is it? And that's the topic of the talk.
Why is it outside called vacuum if it contains particles?
Okay, well.
Convention. There are other states. Yeah. I think that actually is the vacuum with no particles.
Yeah, so.
Overlaps with the one.
Okay. You called it a new vacuum, so.
Yeah. Okay. It's just.
But if it's the old vacuum, then the overlap is one.
Yes.
So the pulse didn't do anything. Yeah.
I think we're just talking about terminology. Let's move on. There's no physics here. So what I want to ask is local information, not just the integral, the effect of action. I want to ask, can I learn something about the effect of Lagrangian? Can I learn something locally in space-time at intermediate times? So what's conventionally done is you take this imaginary part of gamma, and this is the result from Euler and Heisenberg, It's proportional to the square of the electric field. There's an exponential factor, which is m squared pi over the magnitude of the electric field. And you just put the 4-volume in front. And then what's called the locally constant field approximation is you just take this and pretend that the electric field is now space-time dependent and integrate. Okay? Now, it turns out that if you have just a single pulse that's localized in both space and time, this isn't so bad. But clearly, if you have a pulse that's alternating, where the electric field is alternating in sign, this is complete nonsense. Okay? And so we have to understand, how can we go beyond this locally constant field approximation? And how do we even formulate this? So now, these following comments will probably not make any sense to the atomic physicists here. But from the quantum field theory point of view, we understand very well how to do something that's called effective field theory, which is to write a Lagrangian in terms of powers of the field strength, derivatives of the field strength. This is very well understood, very well used in particle physics, nuclear physics, even in atomic physics. But what we really don't know is how to do the corresponding thing in the non-perturbative regime. How do I write, what's the Lagrangian that I should write in that case when the field is has arbitrary space-time
this
variation?
There's an expansion in derivatives. I mean, it's an expansion derivatives over the wavelength of the electron?
Yeah, in this expansion, yeah. The mass. The mass sets the scale, electron masses. Everything is referred to the electron mass. That's the... All right, so as everybody knows, there are huge experimental challenges to getting to these intensities, but I want to stress that there are also really fundamental questions. So, first of all, we don't know whether it can be seen. We haven't seen it. We don't understand optimization. There are basic questions about what actually is a particle in a time-dependent background field, back reaction, cascades. Once this were to start happening, what then happens? Is there some cascade so that it sort of spirals out of control? Does this screen the electric field? There's speculation by a number of groups that in fact there's a maximum possible electric field, which is an extremely strong statement.
Maximum possible electric field, was that one point?
So the argument is that if you increase, say, let's look at the peak location of the electric field, if you increase that amplitude of the electric field to the point where this pair production happens and produces some runaway cascade, that this can actually, the back reaction can screen this and actually suppress the electric field. But nobody, in my opinion, knows how to do a serious calculation of that phenomenon.
This happens in two dimensions.
Okay, but I'm talking about QED. Okay. So, you know, but nobody knows the answer to this, so I'm not going to give you the answer. But I'm stressing that this is an important problem.
So if you consider a plane wave, so let's say a mathematical plane wave, you don't have back production. So you can imagine to approximate the plane wave sufficiently and to increase the intensity, so arbitrarily, and you will not have back production. So I mean, you have a limiting case in which you have a mathematical plane wave, mm-hmm. where you don't have back production. You can have as high intense as you want. Mm-hmm. Then you imagine to approximate this experimentally as better as you can. And in principle, you can do as better as you want and increase the intensity without limit, I think.
Yeah.
So I think in this maximum electric field, at least there was a paper by Narozny, was on colliding electric field. That is different, I think. Mm-hmm. But if you are limited to a single traveling wave, I don't think that there is a limit.
Okay. Anyway.
Could you give some insight into why the time-dependent fields change one's concept of a particle?
This is what the whole talk's about. About this. What I'm actually most interested in the moment is questions of not just particle number, but correlations and quantum noise for particle number and currents and entanglement entry, mutual information. These are all concepts from quantum transport and mesoscopic physics that can be applied to this QED problem. But it requires knowing not just the total particle number after the pulse has happened, it requires knowing something about what's happening during this external perturbation. So that's the motivation. I see I've spent quite a bit of time, but that's okay. So now let me be really specific. I'm going to take my picture of a laser pulse to be a spatially uniform, time-dependent electric field. Okay? Now that's not what a laser pulse looks like, but it's the starting point. Okay? If I do that, the spatial homogeneity means that I can decompose my fields using momentum modes, and I'm just left with essentially a one-dimensional problem for each mode. Okay? That much should be clear. Now, I'm going to, just for sake of notation, I'm going to talk about what's called scalar QED instead of spinner QED. So this is a sort of baby version of QED where you pretend that you have scalar particles that are charged. So the whole Dirac-C concept is a little bit different, but it's just, it's a technicality to make those equations look a little less scary. What it means is that I can take my field and decompose it in terms of creation annihilation operators for particles and antiparticles, and they have some mode functions that are just functions of t and are labeled by these momentum mode labels. And the Klein-Gordon equation, so this would be the Dirac equation if I was talking about spinner QED, for these mode functions just looks like this, where this time-dependent frequency, if you like, is just m squared plus the perpendicular momentum squared, and here's the longitudinal electric field coming from this vector potential. So the time derivative of this vector potential gives me the time-dependent electric field pointing in a particular direction. Okay? There's a direct analog of this in the gravitational cosmological case of an expanding metric. Now, it's been well known for a very long time. One of Dirac's first papers about the Dirac-C points out extremely clearly that if you're in a time-dependent background, there is no unique concept, well-defined concept, of what is negative energy state and what is a positive energy state. So if you're going to start talking about what is particle production at finite time during a pulse, you have to confront this problem. This has been known for ages, and this is what I alluded to. However, if it's slowly varying, and we have to decide what we mean by slowly varying, then you can define an adiabatic particle number. You can make some sort of picture where things are moving slowly, and you can use adiabatic eigenstates of the effect of Hamiltonian, and you can define your particles that way. And then you define a particle number based on that adiabatic approximation. Okay? And so actually, my talk is going to be about the adiabatic approximation. So, and there are some extremely interesting things that are known and not as well known as they should be.
What would be wrong with projecting on instantaneous energy eigenstates and not adiabatic ones?
So why is that a particle?
What is the difference?
I'll show you the difference. No, it makes a difference. I'll show you. No, there's no fundamental reason why that should be an electron or a positron.
Because you use the right energy eigenbasis for that instant of time during the dynamics. Usually one would use, we started with projection of free states.
But those
have only a meaning once there's no potential. So why not then including the effect of the potential and projecting onto energy eigenstates that include the potential? Of course, I'm not talking about a supercritical case.
No, but what you want to define?
The separation between positive and negative energy states is still possible.
Okay, so here we have the divide between real quantum field theory and relativistic quantum mechanics. You really need to define the Dirac-C picture self-consistently, and I mean, there is no unique definition of what is a particle and what is an antiparticle if the background is time dependent. That's just the way it is. But this is something we should continue to discuss. Okay, so it sounds like I can't continue because I just told you that I can't do what I want to do. So let me tell you how you can actually evade this problem to some degree. And that's why I said this talk is a little bit non-standard from the field theory point of view. So what is one approach? There are four or five different approaches to this problem. They're all equivalent computationally. I'm going to choose one. It's called the Bogoliubov transformation approach, where you take your initial Fock operators that define the Dirac C before anything happens, so there's no question what's a negative energy state and what's a positive energy state. And I'm going to apply what's called a Bogoliubov transformation to it. It's a time-dependent mixing, and I'll use that to define time-dependent creation annihilation operators. And I'm going to just declare that I'm going to define a particles and antiparticles with respect to these creation annihilation operators. And I have to tell you where this comes from. For unitarity, this has to have determinant 1. I'm talking about scalar QED, which is why there's a funny minus sign here. For spinner QED, there'd be a plus sign. So what it means is I can take my field, I can decompose it with respect to the initial creation annihilation operators, but I can rewrite these guys in terms of certain reference mode functions. So these are the guys I choose to write as solutions that are positive and negative energy. And I can either interpret that changing of F in terms of these mode functions, reference mode functions, I can view it as a mixing of the creation annihilation operators. It's not complicated, okay? But I have to now tell you, how do I choose these mode functions, and therefore, how do I learn what the time evolution of these alpha and beta are? Once I've made this choice, the particle number is defined in this way. It's the vacuum expectation value in the initial vacuum, the vacuum that's annihilated by these original guys, but it's these time-dependent creation annihilation operator, number operator, in that state. Right? Definition. That's the adiabatic particle number as a function of t. It's a simple piece of juggling creation annihilation operators to show that this is just modulus squared of this beta coefficient here, the off-diagonal guy. Okay? Then the total number of particles produced in a given mode K, remember K is labeling the momentum mode, think of mainly the momentum mode along the direction of the field, is just this value at T equals plus infinity after the pulse has happened. Okay? So this is the quantity that I get from this log debt that Schwinger and Feynman developed. I get this quantity. Okay, but I want this quantity as a function of t. All right, so how do we get that? How do we get access to that? And if I try to access this, I immediately confront this problem of what does it mean to define the particle concept of finite time. It's not unique because it depends on this choice of reference mode functions, even though actually the final value is unique. So let me show you some examples. This is an example of a single electric field pulse of a particular shape, and I've chosen some reasonable parameters. There are two curves here, red and blue. One corresponds to a particular choice of mode functions, and the other corresponds to a different choice of mode functions. And these are the two most popular choices in the literature. As a function of time, it starts at zero, large oscillations. Here's where the pulse is happening. It's roughly here. Very large oscillations. Let me blow up this final region here. They go to the same final value, but at intermediate times, these are extremely different. They're extremely different in many ways. The magnitude is very different, and the time dependence is very different. Okay? So now, what do I say? At particle number at finite time, is it the blue curve or is it the red curve? So that's what this talk's about. All right. So now more detail. What do we actually do? Well, what's the standard approach in the literature? Is that you write the mode functions in terms of a WKB type approximation. That's the canonical choice. So you write these F tilde as some sort of WKB with the WKB prefactor. This goes back to Louville, Green, Stokes, hundreds of years. If you plug this form into the equation that the F has to satisfy, there must be a relation between this capital W and omega. Remember what omega was? It was the omega squared is like the potential in this Klein-Gordon equation. So there has to be a relation between capital W and small omega in order for this to satisfy the equation. Now, the leading order WKB is just where you take capital W to be omega. Right? And that's just ordinary WKB. Since this is a time-dependent problem, you also have to specify the momentum mode, which means you have to say something about F dot. And F dot, it's not clear what to say about F dot. Do you just differentiate this? Do you also differentiate this? Do you allow for some extra function? You can include some arbitrary function here without messing up unitarity. And this freedom in choosing W and in choosing this extra V encodes the arbitrariness in the fact that you can't say what's a positive energy and what's a negative energy state. And there's a good analogy in quantum mechanics. Actually, even in ordinary electromagnetism. Imagine you're propagating a wave through a dielectric, and the dielectric is layered in some way, so the dielectric constant is changing as a function of x. You send in a wave, of course something comes back and something goes that way. In the middle, you can't tell me how much of the wave is going that way or going that way, okay? If it's varying in space. This is exactly the same problem, but in the time domain. So here are the two famous choices, conventional choices. You just use the WKB and you set this extra V thing in F dot to zero. So this is a choice that was made by Popov, by Berzin, by myself in some papers. This is an absolutely standard choice. And then the time evolution of these alpha and beta Bogdanov coefficients looks like this. There's an off-diagonal mixing which involves the integral of omega. Okay? However, there's another perfectly valid choice. This is a choice chosen by some other groups, in particular the work by Kluger, Mottola, and Eisenberg makes the choice of including a derivative of W over W, which basically just comes from differentiating this thing here. And then you get a slightly different equation for the evolution of alpha and beta. Okay? Now, these have the property that as you evolve, alpha and beta, remember the modulus squared of beta is the adiabatic particle number, okay? Now at t equals plus infinity, you get exactly the same answer for either of these equations, but at t finite, you don't. So for example, those two curves I showed you before, the blue curve came from this and the red curve came from that. Okay. All right, so this is what you do in this Bogdanov approach. You start at t equals minus infinity with everything in the alpha, so just negative energy states, that's the field Dirac C. You evolve and you end up at t equals plus infinity, alpha and beta have now changed, and the modulus squared of beta at t equals plus infinity, that's the particle number. Okay, and you do it for each momentum mode k. They don't mix if it's a spatially uniform problem. Now a useful analogy, and this was stressed by Popov, by Berzin and company, and he goes back to the work of Feynman actually, is that this ratio of mod beta squared to mod alpha squared can be thought of as a reflection probability for the over the barrier scattering in the Klein-Gordon equation, but it looks like a Schrödinger equation in the time domain. So I've just taken the Klein-Gordon equation, rewritten it so it looks like a Schrödinger equation. Think of this as minus d by dx squared. This is a potential. This is the energy eigenvalue. Okay? And so a reflection coefficient means you've got something going backwards in time, that's a positron. You've got something going forwards in time, that's an electron. This is Feynman's interpretation of first quantized QED. Now, having said that, once you think of it in this language, we can now study some of these different shaping effects and learn how quantum interference affects things. So, again, let's think of changing the form, the time form of this pulse and see what happens to this. Okay, so there have been various suggestions over the last five or so years. I'm just going to mention some that I've been involved with. So with Holger Gies and Ralph Schutzold, this dynamical Schwinger mechanism is that if you combine a strong slow field with a fast weak field, such that neither of them separately produces any appreciable number of positrons, actually the combination of the two leads to exponential enhancement. And the picture here is you combine an optical laser field with an X-ray laser field, neither of which on its own would do anything, but the combination of the two has a dramatic increase. And this was further elaborated by Antonino and company. So here's a picture that I stole from their paper because their picture was much nicer than our picture. So here's a combination of the two fields. And the basic physics here is that if you have a slow field, the pair production is basically an ionization, a tunneling effect. Whereas the fast field, it's more like a multi-photon effect. But if both of these on their own are such that neither of them works, gives an appreciable result, the combination can give a dramatic increase because you almost multi-photon ionize from the Dirac seed to the continuum, but you don't have enough. This isn't fast enough. But then the tunneling that you have to do is significantly low. And because it's an exponential effect in the tunneling, you get a dramatic increase. And this is one of the ways you can lower the critical field by three orders of magnitude without a lot of work. Okay? Now another interesting effect that...
The critical field?
The critical intensity, sorry. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that's a typo. Okay, another interesting example, this was done with fluorine, is that the carrier phase effect, so this is also an example where I learned something very interesting from one of my colleagues who's an atomic physicist. He kept telling me that the carrier phase is very important in atomic ionization. And some of them we thought, okay, let's explore what it does in vacuum polarization. And there's a dramatic effect. So this was done numerically with fluorine, is that you take your field now to be some Gaussian envelope, with some harmonic stuff underneath, but you allow for a phase shift between the peak of the cosine and the peak of the envelope. Okay? And when this is, when phi is zero and phi equals pi over two, this is the momentum spectrum along the longitudinal direction of the produced particles. And there's a dramatic difference. And if you just use the locally constant field approximation, you wouldn't see any of these oscillations. It would just be a smooth shape like that. Okay, so this is actually a time domain analog, it turns out, of the multiple slit interference effect, but here from vacuum. So this is kind of interesting and cool. And it's also a very sensitive measure of sub-cycle pulse structure. So let's dream about what might happen in 50 years' time, if you can actually design these pulses and see vacuum pair production routinely, as was probably a dream to atomic physicists in the 60s, but let's dream now about doing this from vacuum, you would have access to extremely short timescales from this. Okay? Now, you can understand this. Another thing that you can do, also borrowed from atomic physics, this is work with Eric Ackermans from Technion, is that you can now send sequences of pulses. It was the Ramsey type idea that you send in a pulse, you wait, you send in another pulse, you wait, et cetera, et cetera. If you alternate the signs of these pulses, you flip the sign of the electric field alternating, then in fact you get coherent enhancement. And so here what I've drawn is for two pulses and here for 10 pulses, the envelope here is four times what you would get if you had one pulse, and here the envelope is 100 times what you would get if you had one pulse. And you see what happens is that the mode distribution, this is the number of particles as a function of the momentum mode, it redistributes itself such that you get this multiple slit interference pattern, and at the peak, you can have 100 times what you would get with one pulse. Okay? So in a world where you're just on the edge of seeing this, 100 times increase might actually be useful. And this is very cheap. And this is exactly a time domain analog of the N-slit interference experiment. This has actually been done in atomic physics. Gerhard Paulsen's group did this, I don't know, 15 years ago maybe, in atomic physics. This is the vacuum analog of this. It's actually very recently been done in mesoscopic physics by Julien Gabelli and Bertrand Roulet. Just a couple of years ago, in tunnel junctions, there's an analog of this. All right, so what's going on? I kept saying the word quantum interference, so let's go back and look at this Klein-Gordon equation, and let's view it as this Schrodinger equation. But remember, it's Schrodinger equation, it's an analog Schrodinger equation. So T is not T, T is X in this analog. And the important thing is this minus sign here. The potential is negative, okay? The energy is positive. M is the biggest mass scale. So this is not just positive, it's big and positive, okay? So the reflection probability here, it's an over the barrier scattering problem, and the probability of reflection is going to be exponentially small because M is big, because you're very far above this potential that's down here, okay? So you really can use semi-classical techniques here to calculate this. But it's a little bit unconventional because there are no turning points because the energy is way above the potential. But that's a mirage. There are turning points, but they're in the complex plane. Okay, so this is what's called complex WKB. And if you have a single pulse, since the pulse is actually a real function because it's a laser pulse, it's a real laser pulse, these complex turning points come in complex conjugate pairs. And if you have just a single pulse, there's always one pair that dominates everything. But if you have subcycle structure, then there can be multiple pairs that have the same distance from the real axis and so give the same contribution. Once that happens, you know that there can be quantum interference between these. And so if you can control where these turning points sit, you have exquisite sensitivity for the reflection probability, therefore the particle production, by shifting the locations of these poles. And that's the whole idea. There's an integral, think of it like this. Here's the complex T-plane. There could be a complex pair of turning points here, but there might be another one here. The magnitude of the effect comes from doing an integral between here and here. Oh, sorry. Okay, I went one there. So this is in Landau-Lipschitz. You do an integral in the complex direction for a single one. But if you have two of them, then there can also be interference between them. Okay? All right. So, all right, I'm going to have to accelerate because there's no way. All right. Okay, so there's a more technical, mathematical explanation of this done with my student. Is that you can really do a semi-classical treatment based on this so-called Stokes phenomenon, and it works extremely well. So I can tell people about that in private later if you want. So now we go back to this carrier phase effect. When the phase was zero, it's just cosine. When the phase was pi over two, it was sine. You look at these, and you can't really see a big difference. You look at the fields, but if you look at the turning points, there's a very big difference. In this case, there's one dominant pair. In this case, there's two dominant pairs. As you change k, which is the momentum of the produced particles, these guys move around, but there's always one pair in this case and two pairs in that case. So in this case, you have quantum interference. In this case, you don't.
You can see from the wave function, you have two maximum electric fields, where you have twice as many trajectories as in your left.
But there's too much information in this picture than you need. Okay. If you're going to do an optimization problem, what you want is you want the bare minimum information that you need. And I claim there's too much there, and this is what you actually need. Okay, so now I'm finally coming to what I wanted to talk about. So what effect does this quantum interference have, not just on the total yield, which is what I mentioned before? What I said so far was the total particle number produced. It was dramatically affected by this quantum interference. What I want to really ask about now is what's happening near these turning points. So I'm evolving from t equals minus infinity to t equals plus infinity. Everything is controlled by these guys, but they're off the real axis. Okay? But what happens in the vicinity here? What happens around this time or this time? What's actually, how are things changing? So technically, there's a turning point and its complex conjugate. There's what's called a Stokes line, which is a line along which the imaginary part of this omega stays fixed, and that defines a line which connects these two. It intersects the real axis at some point, and usually this is relatively close to this for fields that we're interested in. But this is actually a curve. So what's happening near this turning point? So let's go back and look at this adiabatic expansion again. Remember, something's weird here. You write this mode function as the exponential of this integral of capital W divided by the square root of capital W. And the relation between capital W and this potential, and remember the gauge field sits inside omega. Okay, the time dependence is sitting in here. The leading order of the adiabatic expansion is just you take this to be equal to this. The next to leading order, you expand in derivatives of omega. You get another term. The next to next to leading order looks like this. And if anybody's ever played with these higher order WKB or higher order adiabatic expansions, you know that things rapidly become disastrously complicated. Okay? All these tons of terms, it grows very fast, and it looks hopeless. However, some amazing structure here was discovered by Dingell in the mid-60s and then exploited by Michael Berry in the late 80s, early 90s. And it goes like this. The story is the adiabatic expansion is divergent. So this story that we usually tell our students that, well, the time derivatives are small, so we neglect these terms, complete nonsense. Okay? It's much more interesting than that. That's a really cheap way out of the story. Okay? It's divergent. You know it's divergent, and this is Stokes's great contribution, is that if you're going to write the solution to a differential equation like this, introducing square roots of omega and fourth roots of omega, square roots of omega squared, the potential, and fourth root of omega squared, you've just introduced non-analyticity into a problem that was analytic. And so the expansions around the corrections to that leading behavior must be divergent. Otherwise, there's no way you can reconstruct the analytic solution. And this is Stokes's great insight to studying wave propagation. So it looks hopeless and uninteresting, but Dingell found some amazing universal behavior. Namely, this is his argument. Let's define something called the singulant. It's the integral from this complex turning point to some arbitrary point t of omega, conventionally with a factor of one. Right? So this is f of t. So think of just changing variables from t to f of t. And now let's expand capital W in terms of omega, but then there are all these weird corrections from the adiabatic expansion. And let's call them little phi. So as you go higher and higher orders, these phis become extremely complicated. Many, many terms, many, many derivatives, many, many powers, extremely complicated. Dingell discovered that in fact at large orders in this expansion, one term captures everything. So there's a factorial and this guy to some power. Okay? This is incredible. Okay? So let me show you how incredible it is. Here's one of these Schwinger examples. Here's the various orders of the adiabatic expansion. Here are the number of terms if you dare to sit down and write them out. And here's a plot, first order, second order, third, fourth, fifth, blah, 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 of the actual function and this approximation. And I don't even remember which is which. They're so close. Right? At first order and second order, well, you can distinguish a little bit. But by third order, you essentially can't tell the difference. Okay? Right? So that's interesting. That's a basic fact about high order WKB and about the adiabatic expansion. Now, Michael Berry used this fact in the two-level problem in a time-dependent background, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and we're borrowing those results in this quantum field theory case, to show that this time-dependent Bogdanov coefficient has a universal behavior near this point. So in fact, it is always the case, if you have one pair of turning points like this, that the time dependence of this has a very simple form. It's an error function, the integral of a Gaussian, the error function, time sub magnitude, which is basically just the final value. And the argument is just essentially linear in the displacement from this intersection point. Okay? And the final value here is an exponential of something involved in this omega. Okay? So this is completely universal, and it came technically speaking from a Borel resummation of this characteristic large order behavior. Okay, so I don't expect anybody to, I didn't even bother to try and give you a derivation, I just quoted a result. Let me show you how it works with examples. So if we take this result at face value, then the modulus squared of this is our adiabatic particle number. So we now have a universal formula for the time evolution of the particle number. Okay? Now remember also that if you have an asymptotic expansion, not a convergent expansion, the order at which you should truncate the expansion depends on the value of the variable. Whereas with a convergent expansion, you just add more terms and things get better. Okay? So there should be an optimal order of truncation of this adiabatic expansion. And this Berry Dingell result is that the optimal order of truncation is related to the magnitude of this final value here in this way. It's the integer part of this. So let's see how it works. So here, this is particle production in a single pulse like this for a particular value of momentum and a particular pulse profile. The blue curve is zeroth order or first order or whatever in the adiabatic expansion. The red curve is this function. Okay? So zeroth order gives this. It goes up where the pulse happens and it settles. Of course, it has to go to the same final value. Next order in the adiabatic expansion, the scale has changed. This peak here is much lower. You go to next order like this, third order like this. I chose the parameters of this pulse such that J was 3 in this case. Okay? And you see it's tracking it. If I go further, if I go beyond 3, I start getting nonsense, these unphysical peaks in the vicinity of the pulse, and it gets worse if I keep going further. So let me show you on one plot, zeroth order, first order, second order, third order, fourth. So this is the universal behavior. Okay? So the idea, the super adiabatic, what it means is you accept that the adiabatic expansion is asymptotic. It should be optimally truncated. You don't know where to optimally truncate it, because if I change the parameters of the pulse, you have to go to a different order. So it looks like, again, you're stuck. But because of this universal behavior, you're not stuck. There's a universal formula, which means that you don't have to do the adiabatic expansion. And you just know that if you were to do it, you would get this answer. Okay? All right. So that was for a simple pulse, but a realistic pulse has not just one pair, there can be multiple pairs. So we have to deal now with the interference effect. So we extend this result of Berry, but it's not just what's happening near here, it's what's happening near this, the second part of the pulse, if you like. What's the interference between these? And since this is the modulus squared of an amplitude, the amplitude is just a sum of what's happening at the different turning points with a phase factor interference effect between, which is an integral between here and here. Okay? So we can test how well this works. So let me go to this case of a pulse and an antipulse separated by some distance. When you do this, the momentum distribution of the produced particles looks exactly like the double slit interference pattern, because that's what it is. And so there are certain momenta where you get 4 times what you would have gotten with one pulse, and there are other momentum where you get 0. So we can look at what's happening for momentum such that I get this or momentum such that I get 0. And it's very different. So this is a case with a peak here. And again, zeroth order, there's something big happening, it settles down, something big happening, it settles down. I go to the next order of the adiabatic expansion, the scale has changed again. These transient effects are much smaller. You go on, again I chose third order to be the optimal. If I go beyond, I start getting these transient effects again. So here they are all. This one's the optimally truncated super adiabatic particle number. And so it has a beautiful physical interpretation. I apply a pulse, I produce some particles, then I apply another pulse, and there's some interference between those guys. And this final peak is four times the intermediate peak because it's an interference effect. It's a coherent interference effect. It's not twice, it's four times. Now I can look at a momentum such that it's a minimum, and you have these transient effects, and it goes back to zero. So again, I can go along to order. If I go beyond the optimal order, I start getting these transients again, plot it all on the same figure. This is the optimally truncated thing. Smooth during the pulses, not just at asymptotic times. That's the whole idea. So using this fact about the adiabatic expansion, you can, in fact, define an adiabatic particle number, which here I'm calling super adiabatic because of the optimal truncation. That's a piece of terminology from this differential equations literature. You also see that it's coherent constructive interference. If I have 2, it goes from 1 to 4. If I have 3, it goes from 1 to 4 to 9, et cetera, et cetera. It's going like n squared, these plateaus. That's telling you that it's coherent constructive interference. Okay? You're adding amplitudes. Okay, I can even do this in the time domain and the momentum domain. I can have a sequence. I can look not just at the total, but at the momentum distribution. And so this is what it looks like. This is the momentum along the pulse, and this is time. There's nothing. I apply one pulse. I just have a smooth momentum distribution, which is just like I would get if I just had one pulse. Then the other pulse hits at this time, and suddenly the momentum distribution changes to a two-slit interference pattern. I apply a third pulse, and it changes to a three-slit interference pattern, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't have, in this supra-adiabatic basis, I don't have any of this distracting, unphysical, transient effects happening when the pulses occur. Okay? All right, there are various cross-sections. Okay, so let me just summarize by saying the super-adiabatic particle number, it's smooth in time. These unphysical transient effects are smoothed out, and it's smooth in the momentum. Now, this would not be a sensible definition if it were not for this universality. If I simply told you that the adiabatic expansion was asymptotic, and therefore the order at which you should stop the adiabatic expansion depends on the parameters, that would not be a useful statement. Because if I simply change the momentum, not even change the pulse, I just change the momentum that I'm asking about, then I have to optimally truncate it in a different order. So that's crazy to define a basis that way. But because of this universality, that it's actually in the end independent of actually doing the truncation, no matter what order the optimal truncation happens, the final answer is the same. Because of that, it's a useful definition. Okay? This is extremely important. It's only that universality that makes this useful. All right, now, I don't know whether it's worth. Let me just show you 2 slides about this. So there's an analogy in cosmological particle production. So one of the best studied cases is what's called de sitter or anti-de sitter. They're 2 cases of time-dependent evolution of the radius, if you like, of the cosmology. So there's particle production in 4-dimensional space-time in de sitter space. This was shown long ago by Emma Mottola. There's particle production in even-dimensional de Sitter space, but not in odd-dimensional de Sitter space. And this was a calculation done in the S-matrix way by a number of people. Very nice paper by Bousseau et al. About maybe 10 years ago. So this raises the question, you know, why should it be that in one dimension or another, you either have or have not final particle number? And in fact, if you're in 3-dimensional de Sitter space, why? How can the final answer be zero? You start with zero and it just stays zero? No. What's the physics here? And the answer is kind of interesting. So this is 4 dimensions, and zeroth order, adiabatic, et cetera. There's a rate at which this is expanding, okay? So you can do the adiabatic expansion. Zeroth first order. And it looks exactly like the 2 electric field pulses with constructive interference. Okay, so this plateau is four times this plateau. Okay? And that's in four-dimensional space-time, so that's the standard result. If you look now in three-dimensional space-time, you see that the final value is zero, and it's zero because of quantum interference. It's destructive interference in three dimensions, where it's constructive interference in four dimensions. And you only see this clearly, you don't see this very well in the, if you use the naive leading order adiabatic expansion, but you see it very clearly in this super adiabatic basis. Okay, so sorry, I've gone a little over time. Let me just summarize. The adiabatic particle number is basis dependent. There is no unique definition of particles or antiparticles at intermediate time. However, mathematically speaking, there actually is. There's this preferred, optimally truncated, super adiabatic basis in which everything is smooth and in which you see the physics of quantum interference happening. Now, that's a different statement from saying this is a physically sensible definition of particles that I can measure as particles. Right? So I want to stress that there's still a distinction to be made there. But what I find surprising about this is that there exists such a special basis, and moreover, in that special basis, there's a very simple behavior of the particle number that is universal, given the turning point structure of fields. Once you know that, you can actually now work backwards and not talk about just changing the shape of the fields. You write down your fields and you see where the turning points go, and you tune the locations of the turning points to get the desired result. It's a much more efficient way of thinking about the optimization problem and the control problem. And so this is more clearer in the superadiabatic particle number basis because these transients are just completely unphysical. What I'm actually working on and what I hope to do in the future is see what the implications of this are for back reaction, because I just talked about particle number, but I can apply the same argument now to the current, because the current, the expectation value of the current, is what I have to put in to the Maxwell equations to try and get a self-consistent back reaction problem. But if I want to do that, I need the time-dependent current. Okay? So before I understand the time-dependent current, I have to understand the time-dependent particle number. The time-dependent current is a little bit more complicated because the renormalization effect is more subtle for the current, but this is the first step towards studying that. And also correlation functions of number at different times. This is what's called quantum noise in mesoscopic physics or quantum transport. And you can't begin to talk about that until you know the particle number or the currents as a function of time, not just at t equals plus or minus infinity. And there are many analog systems that various people are studying in solid state, in the quantum dots, cold atoms. There are many, many systems which have similar behavior. They're not, none of them is exactly QED, obviously, because they can't be exactly QED, but you can still study some of these enhancement effects and quantum control effects in these analog systems. And various ideas about this are being done both theoretically and experimentally. So let me stop there. Thank you.
Questions? When do non-adiabatic effects occur? I mean, your system is completely adiabatic, so it allows you to apply unique states.
Okay, so.
But I mean.
There are still timescales, obviously.
Yeah.
Right? And it's a question of how far apart are these guys. If these guys come together and coalesce, then clearly something interesting is happening. That's actually understood what happens when these coalesce. But now it's a question of, do you try to make your pulse so rapidly varying that these turning points are so close together that actually you can't distinguish between these? So then now it's a matter of timescales. And what I'm claiming is that in the examples we've considered where you have reasonable envelope length, there's enough room for, say, several cycles where you can actually do something. But you can clearly theoretically think of a case where it's so rapidly oscillating that you have to go even beyond this.
Because Stupelberg 75 years ago did the same thing you did, WKB in the complex plane, right?
Yeah, I mean, forget Stuckelberg, Louisville did this 300 years before. Okay, I mean, all of this existed long, long ago. So in fact, let me make a sort of announcement. You know, if you're interested in learning details about this higher order WKB, the best book that exists is a book about, it's called Ionization in the Atmosphere. It's about propagating electromagnetic waves in the ionosphere by Button. And it has an extremely precise mathematical and physical description of complex WKB. And this was written
in the name of the author?
Button, B-U-D-D-E-N. And it's something like ionization in the atmosphere or something. So this is very generic. It's not just about quantum filters. So at least for the atomic physicists here, let me just hope that you got one message from this, is that there's something very interesting in the higher order structure of the adiabatic approximation. Okay? And a lot is known about it.
So if I understand the main the mechanism you have for increasing intensity is essentially interference, taking a wave and which concentrate, I mean, gives you this n square effect locally in momentum.
Right.
So, but the total number, of course, doesn't change.
Right. So if you think about an observation, the observer is not necessarily going to just count the total number. They're going to have a detector. And if they see a huge peak at some momentum, well, who cares? They see something. That's the first step, just to see something. And so I claim that it's actually useful to concentrate momentum. So we tried taking disordered pulses, because in condensed matter physics it's well known that if you take disordered sequences you can get very interesting spectral response. And we were hoping for exponential enhancement rather than n squared enhancement, but it didn't. You still get dramatic increases, but for some reason it didn't turn out to be exponential. So these are the sort of games. The optimization problem, as AMO people use it, is very well developed. We're not yet at that stage. Okay? We're at the stage at this point of understanding some of the physics of how you can enhance, and then you make guesses of what sort of pulses you can. But this is the basic mechanism. But several scenarios of how to implement it, but it's the basic physical mechanism. But this is, a few years. We're still working on this. And I really believe that this quantum control formalism can be extended to this ultra-relativistic regime and a quantum field theory regime, not just single particle Dirac equation like you do for atomic physics.
Harding, you had a question?
So in the context of quantum relativistic many body theory, there's a well-defined way of generalizing finding dynamics to the case of driven systems. Right? This is the Kerr-Leach-Green's function, as Kerr-Leach and Bain and Rochelle equations in motion. Now, this ultimately leads to something like a time-dependent spectral function. So spectral function, this is really what makes a contact to experiment. So this is the imaginary part of a particular component of this Kerr-Leach piece. So now I wonder, do the same thing here.
Yes.
This would go beyond the adiabatic limitation that you have.
Yeah, so the formalism exists. This was actually Schwinger wrote seven papers in a few years on this topic. And one of them is specifically about the time-dependent backgrounds, and it's explicitly in the language of time-dependent Green's functions. And this is Schwinger-Keldysh. This is where it came from. And the problem is, it's extremely hard to implement for these non-perturbative calculations. But the formalism is there, and it hasn't been exploited. There are some differences because of the different causal structure and whatever, but I think these are details. I think the basic ideas are in this. Because ultimately, this is a non-equilibrium process in these time-dependent backgrounds, and we don't really understand non-equilibrium quantum field theory very well.
That the definition of the particle number during the interaction depends on how, that's arbitrary, I understand, because it depends on how you're splitting up the electron-positron field operator into an electronic and positronic portion. That's understood.
These are these alpha of t and beta of t.
Exactly, yeah. But you also mentioned that would have implications for the current density. And this I don't understand, because that thingy, like for the zeros component, just always psi dagger psi, end of the story. It does not depend on how we are splitting psi itself. So it should be universal. If I look at Florian's work, there should be no question about what the current density, even during an interaction, is, because always just psi dagger psi.
The current density is. So I'm talking about the current along the longitudinal direction is just proportional to modulus of beta squared also.
But the current density is also it's always psi beta psi.
Which is proportional to beta dot, the beta squared dot, so the derivative of beta squared. So there's two confusions.
But how you make it, so it depends, let me just say this, it depends on beta, so therefore it depends on the how you define it.
So you say that the charge cannot be uniquely defined during an interaction. The charge distribution.
Right.
Cannot.
Just like the particle.
But the particle is different.
But if you,
but based on an arbitrary separation of the weight of the operator into the electronic and positronic portion. Like what is A referring to, what B data, what kind of mode does it excite? But we don't have that choice for the current operator, which has a unique definition, it's psi dagger psi.
We have to talk about
this. As an experimentalist, let's assume that the lasers get there, right? It seems to me, am I right in thinking that using the interference that you have shown very nicely, right, like in the basic atomic physics, adding pulses playing with the CP, it seems to me the most interesting thing about this is that you have a way to imprint a signature on the effect that you want to measure, because experimentally you want to distinguish the effect that you want to see from all kinds of background effects that we all have.
So for example, so this momentum distribution, it's extremely characteristic of this effect. So you may have some experimental broadening and whatever of the distribution, but if you see this interference type effect, and I only talked about the behavior along the longitudinal direction, there's also interesting behavior in the transverse direction that I didn't discuss, this will tell you that it's really coming from this. It's not some positron coming from somewhere else. As I said, this is in the future. You have to get there first, but you can then think of using this in the backward direction of from momentum distribution or energy distributions, learning something about what's happening inside the pulse.
And very it's a unique signature.
Yeah, and very characteristic.
I want to make sure that I understand this analogy right. So you showed this analogy with the Schrodinger equation, reflection from the over barrier reflection. So does that mean if I can optimize the shape of the potential such that I have maximum reflection, that would give me the maximum cap reduction?
You could really formulate this as a one-dimensional scattering problem in quantum mechanics.
So is there something known about the best shape? Because we know shapes of potential that give no reflections, we know that, so maybe there's also...
The problem is that they're very complicated. Things are known about simple examples of square wells and two pieces. But if you have many pieces, thinking in terms of the shape of the potential is just the wrong way to think about the problem.
Yeah.
is what I claim.
Yeah,
the right way to. Yeah, but you know, then you want to add many, and you want to have this. I think it's the wrong way to think about the problem, but it's exactly the same problem. But there's the added sort of caveat is that the potential involves the vector potential. Okay, that's gauge dependent, so I have to be a little bit careful here. Now, it's some function of t. I want to choose a of t to be some function of t, but I want, say, a fixed intensity. I don't want to cheat by just increasing the intensity. So I want to choose a potential such that the integral of, say, a dot squared is something fixed, and then I want to change the time profile such that I increase it. But then I want something else, because as I change k, k has nothing to do with my choice of a. As I change k, the shape of this thing dramatically changes. Okay? So this is this question of, you know, you want to choose a such that in some mode k, there'll be a big peak. So that it's not just choosing the potential so you get most reflection. And that's why I think this optimization problem with general space, it hasn't been precisely formulated yet, but I don't see a big problem in the case where it's just a time-dependent field. A much more interesting question is if it's spatially focused and it has a magnetic component and whatever. That's a much harder question. But if it's just time-dependent, linearly polarized electric field, I think it's accessible.
What would couple different k's? Different fk's?
Spatial inhomogeneity.
Okay.
If it's spatially uniform. But usually the spot size is so big compared to the quantum wavelength that it's probably physically not so important, although theoretically I think it's extremely interesting mathematically. There actually have been some interesting results from real mathematicians in the ionization case recently. They regard this as a very interesting problem of having spatially localized electric fields and non-trivial time dependence in the ionization problem. To them, that's a fantastic playground.
Okay. For your multiple pulse enhancement, do I understand this right, that at the moment these were just two half-cycle pulses with opposite sign?
So, in fact, you can take any pulse and just wait and take the same pulse flipped.
Does the internal time structure within each of the pulses?
Well, that so we have to. So imagine I showed the example just for simplicity of one pulse and another pulse, okay? And so you get an n squared enhancement over what you would have if you had one pulse. Now, if this one pulse had its own interesting substructure which gave an enhancement just for it itself, that's already an enhancement. But if I repeat the same guy flipped in sign, I'll get an extra factor of 4 enhancement on top. So you can combine these things to. And that's why the optimization problem is not yet, right? Because you can do this, you can do this. Do you, how much of this should you do? And
is that the Ramsey effect you talked earlier?
Yeah, that's what he was asking. The thing that isn't completely obvious is that you should change the phase, that you change the sign of the electric field for this. But that's how it works out in the QED case. In atomic cases or solid state cases, it's not necessarily changing of sign, it's just sending a pulse, sending another pulse. But in this QED case, there's an important flip of sign.
Actually, we did some calculations on
Bragg's
Wheeler process. Exact same mechanism as what you said. So we had a train of pulses which were colliding with a high energy photon, right? And we looked at the spectrum of the produced positrons.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't need a sign change within the train to see actually such enhancement like you do.
Okay.
And we did this for different values of cycles within each of those pulses.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we see this. All the features that you described,
yeah.
Starting with, I don't know, to cycle pulses.
Yeah, but it's a different process.
Yeah, it's a different process.
This phase shift is specifically for the vacuum air production. But just generically speaking, you send in a pulse, you wait, you send in another pulse, something interesting is going to happen. That's what Ramsey.
I mean, this is just a general feature. We see this in the conference
catalyst. Clearly.
All right, let's thank Gerald for the very interesting talk.